Welcome back to the Segment Tips Podcast, everybody. I am Kaylee Fretz, and we just had, well, kind of the premier bike racing weekend of the entire season, perhaps. Next weekend was supposed to be the crazy day with Roubaix and the first women's Roubaix and a Giro stage and a Vuelta stage, but obviously Roubaix has been canceled, so last weekend might have been it, might have been the best bike racing day of the year, and we're going to talk all about it. We're going to talk about Flanders, we're going to talk about Julian Alaphilippe, we're going to talk about Jumbo-Visma's new women's team, the Giro, the coming Vuelta, bike musical chairs, and by that I mean bike sponsor musical chairs. There's some movement on that front. And finally, in today's Nerd Alert, we're chatting about wired versus wireless. And of course, we're not talking about remote controls or anything there. We're talking about drivetrains, shifting. We have the usual crew with us here today. James, you're back from Moab. That looked terrible. I feel really bad for you.
It did look terrible. That was a very quick weekend away. I took Friday off sort of as a little mini birthday celebration for myself. And then I came back very late last night, and I'm very tired. And oddly enough, the thing that is most sore is the back of my neck, probably from holding up my head from all those landings coming down whole enchilada.
The whole enchilada, for those who don't know, is, well, you take a shuttle up to about 9,000 feet, then you ride up to about 11,000 feet.
You go up to about 10 and you top out at about 11.
Yeah, so you ride a bit and then you descend for like 32 miles or something insane like that. It's real sweet. If you haven't done it, go to Moab. Go do it. Shoddy Dave.
Good day.
Your hair is looking magnificent today.
Thank you. That would be the L'Oreal I'm using. Bayo. Style tips coming live and direct from Annecy, France.
Abby?
Hello.
You're wearing your Taylor Swift cardigan again? This has become your official podcast attire.
Definitely, I've definitely taken it off since I got it. I don't sleep in it. But
for showering.
That's about it, yeah.
Or do you just wear it in the shower and like that counts as like washing it at the same time? Is it sort of like an all-in-one sort of thing?
You know, that sounds like a great idea. However, I feel like it would take a while to dry, and when I truly need it is when I get out of the shower, because it snowed like a foot over the weekend and is still snowing here in Montana, so I need it for warmth. And if it was wet, then it wouldn't work.
How's it differ from a standard cardigan? Has it got like, I don't know, Taylor Swift hair knitted into it or something?
If she had to knit her hair into every cardigan she sold, she would be bald now. But if you haven't seen it, which I assume none of the people listening to this podcast have seen it, go watch the cardigan music video with Taylor Swift and you'll understand.
I've seen it, Abby. I already saw it, and then you also sent it to me, so I watched it again.
Well, that's why you're my best friend at Cycling Tips, my best work friend. No offense.
I'm honored. I'm so honored to hear that.
Those, of course, were the dulcet tones of Dane Cash. How are you, Dane?
I'm good. I'm glad to sound dulcet today. I don't always know that I sound dulcet, so that's good. Good to hear.
Particularly dulcet today.
I definitely do not sound dulcet today because I have lungs full of Moab dust that I'm still coughing up.
Yes. Well, today we do have a sponsor for today's episode, Abby.
Yeah, today's podcast is brought to you by the component manufacturer Industry 9. Produced and hand-built in Asheville, North Carolina, Industry 9 is known for their fast engagement, hubs, and wheels. Although traditionally thought of as a mountain bike brand, Industry 9 also brings elements of their mountain bike line to their road and gravel products. New to the Industry 9 lineup for 2020 are the value-friendly 101 road wheels intended for any all-terrain drop bar exploration and especially gravel. The 101 road alloy wheels feature high-capacity off-road proven bearings and 4 degrees between engagement. Faster engagement means you can transfer power at a split second's notice to assist in riding through uneven terrain and accelerating out of corners. Offered in a 700C option with a 24.5 millimeter internal rim width, the 101 Road GRCX is capable of fitting tires ranging from 33 to 55 millimeters.
Hey, Abby, you know, if I didn't know any better, I would almost guess that you're reading from a script.
This was okay, so Kaylee, you gave me this one and I was reading it and I was like, Jesus Christ, I don't know any of this technical stuff.
I don't usually do sponsor stuff here, but I'm just going to go ahead and butt in just a little bit, just mainly because I have purchased a bunch of Industry 9 wheel, Industry 9 hubs and wheels myself. And basically what Abby's trying to say is that Industry 9 now has a cheaper range of wheels and hubs called 101 that give you super fast engagement like their Torch line, but they're cheaper because they only come in black and they kind of miss, they're kind of missing some features, but Kaylee and I both like them.
They're really good. I have i9 hubs on my mountain bikes, two different mountain bikes actually, and have been very, very pleased with them. And the same tech moves over to Gravel World, which is cool. Fast engagement. They seem to be super durable, at least in my experience. Two thumbs up for i9.
Basically, they have two different, they have a road one and they have a trail one that fit different width tires. 33 to 55 millimeter on the road, 40 millimeter to 2.2 inch mountain bike tires on the gravel.
Those are fat.
Visit industry9.com or your local bike shop for more information. Thanks, James, for your help with this week's episode.
Thanks to i9 for sponsoring today's episode. Much appreciated as always. Let's jump right into the episode. We like to waste roughly 8 minutes of your time before we actually start talking about anything, as usual. Tour of Flanders was last weekend. Let's get a rundown of what happened. I want to start with the women's race, even though actually the women's race finished after the men's race once again, which was pretty cool. Abby, you were actually doing commentary for Flow Sports, for Flow Bikes, at the women's race. So obviously you were watching the entire thing. Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, actually, fun fact, the viewing figures for the women's race at Flanders were the highest. It was the highest viewed women's bike race of all time, according to some stats that I saw on Twitter. And people are speculating that has to do with the fact that the women's race finished after the men's race. So that's pretty cool. I mean, definitely from my point of view in the U.S., the women's races, some of the women's races finish like crazy early in the morning, like 5 a.m. in the States. But yeah, cool that there were so many viewing people of the bike race. It was super exciting. One of the craziest parts of the race was when Annemiek van Vleuten attacked and was chased down by a solo Anna van der Breggen. And then when Anna van der Breggen caught up with Van Vleuten, she kind of just sat on her wheel and Van Vleuten sat up. And Anna van der Breggen kind of looked at her like, I'm not going to do anything. And so they both just sat up and got brought back by a chasing group of pretty heavy hitters. From there, the group hit the Eau de Clermont and Chantel Black attacked, Chantel Vandenbroek Black, and she managed to stay away solo for the entire time. In the run into the finish, it looked like it was a possibility that she would get caught after the Paterberg, but the cohesion in the group behind was really bad. And actually, Mitchelton Scott had Grace Brown, who is riding so well right now, and Anna Vandenbroek, Annemiek van Vleuten, and the two of them kept attacking. Like, Grace would go and then Van Vleuten would go, and every single time that one of them would get brought back, the group would just all sit up. So that meant that Chantel Vandenbroek Black finished with a chunk of time. But it was an awesome win for her. And Amy Peters won the sprint for second. So she ended up putting it a Bulls Dolmans 1-2 on the podium with Lotte Kopecky third, the Belgian national champion. So yeah, pretty awesome race.
I really liked seeing, and granted, this is kind of negative racing in the most traditional definition, but I liked seeing Van der Breggen just chase Van Vleuten, get across, and then shut down the move. You know, I think one of the reasons why Van Vleuten has won so frequently over the last 2 years is that people keep working with her. And at some point, you have to not work with people like that, right? I mean, think about all the times that on the men's side, Peter Sagan would you know, try to make a move and someone would go with him and then just wouldn't pull through because they're like, I'm not going to go to the line with you. In Sagan's case, that's because he was a better sprinter. But in Van Vleuten's case, it's because you think she's probably just going to drop you on the next hill anyway. So why on earth would you take a pull? It is very negative racing. It sort of shut down that particular effort, but it also led to that team going 1-2 at the bike race, which is the end goal of the bike race, is to win the bike race. So it was good to see, I think, from a tactical perspective, just teams willing to you know, kind of use the nuclear option, right? Just follow her everywhere and shut her down. Because it made the rest of the race more exciting. If it had just been, you know, those two off the front, rolling turns, there's no way they're getting caught. Race over pretty early. As a result, there was a bit more action in the race.
I just want to say that, you know, even though I was gone all weekend and just getting that recap, it sounds like that race by itself is so much of a counter argument to people saying that women's racing is boring.
Oh, it's so far from boring. I mean, yeah, it was a really exciting race. And one of the really interesting things about that move by Anna van der Breggen was that she was clearly working for her teammates at that moment, because if that had gone to the line, Anna van der Breggen is a better sprinter than Van Vleuten. If Anna van der Breggen would have just sat on Van Vleuten and Van Vleuten would have pulled to the finish, which Van Vleuten was capable of, and Anna van der Breggen would not have been dropped. She was riding the front a ton, which is always fun to see the world champ riding the front in service of her teammates. And it was pretty apparent the entire race that she was working for either Amy Peters or Chantal Vanderbrook Black or Jolene DeHoor, who was just behind them. The question all season has been, how do we beat Van Vleuten? Because she's been so unstoppable all season. And this was kind of the perfect way to do it, because I think Van Vleuten knew that she would lose to Van der Breggen in a sprint. And that's why she didn't keep pulling, because I think if this same exact thing had happened 2-3 months ago, she would have just pulled Van der Breggen all the way to the line. But yeah, she didn't. And it was, Bols Dolmans was just amazing the entire race, really, because getting second in the bunch sprint meant that Chantal Black, even if she'd been brought back, Bols probably still would have won. I mean, being between Capecchi and Amy Peters, like, that's a pretty strong competition, but it was, everyone's yawning, Kaylee's looking at his nails. That's it. That's enough race analysis for me.
Oh my god, Abby, I'm so tired. I can't even begin to tell you.
I'm not yawning. I was listening. I was waiting for you to finish.
No, that was me yawning.
I have a tendency because of the family that I grew up in, which is a very large Roman Catholic Italian family in Boston. I have, where you basically don't talk if you don't talk over other people. And this is a habit I've been trying to break. So I was sitting here quietly waiting for you to finish before I was going to jump in.
I mean, I made my point. Like, yeah, the point that I'm trying to make was just that, like, we wanted to know how we could beat Van Vleuten, and Anna van der Breggen succeeded.
Turns out all you have to do is throw an anchor on her.
Yeah.
Yep. It's a legitimate tactic, right? Like I said, there's always a bit of hemming and hawing about negative riding like that, quote unquote negative riding like that. But really, I don't know. I don't necessarily fully buy it. Like, negative racing is racing. If that's what you have to do to win, then go for it. You know, and if Van Vleuten had taken a bunch of super hard pulls, then Van der Breggen starts pulling again, right? But she was correct in that she did not want to just get across that gap, take a big old pull, and risk Van Vleuten hitting her again, right? That's the danger, because then she's solo. You can't let her go solo. So I think it was a smart thing to do, and it certainly worked out for them. You know, if that happens over and over and over and over again, then Van Vleuten has to figure out a way around it, and that's bike racing.
Feels like kind of a throwback to 2-3 years ago. I feel like Anna van Vleuten has kind of made people forget a little bit how dominant Bols was there for a little while. Bols was just winning everything, and they would do it with multiple different riders, although Van der Breggen was the most dominant. They had a lot of firepower, and they would do stuff like this, and they were incredibly good at it. And then Van Vleuten over the last 2 years has been so strong that I think she has made some people just kind of forget how good Bols Dolmans was. She kind of knocked them off their perch a little bit. But this year, they've definitely come roaring back. And this race in particular, they kind of reminded people that they're still here, and that the sort of team-wide firepower that helped Van der Breggen and others with that team get so many wins over the past 5-6 years was definitely on display. You saw that at Flanders for sure.
Yeah, and that's...
Agreed.
That's just going to... I mean, going into next year, they've signed new riders and really strong riders. They've signed Demi Vollering. And I think they're going to be just as good next year. I mean, they still have Anna van der Breggen for one more year before she retires and becomes a DS for the team. So Yeah, and the other really interesting tactical thing that happened was Mitchelton Scott in the end of the race really shutting down the chase. Like, they were clearly trying to, like, they knew that if they came down to a sprint finish that neither Grace Brown nor Annemiek van Vleuten could compete in the sprint, but by attacking over and over and over, they just gave Chantel more time. So it was, yeah, there was two very interesting team tactics at work in the race, and one of them worked and one of them was pretty bad. Although, like, very, very entertaining to watch.
Yeah, makes for good racing.
Yeah.
Let's move over to the men's side. So men's race, just about 45K to go, up and over the Koppenberg. Three riders are able to gain a bit of separation. There's a whole lot of movement around that time, but the important thing here is that three riders were able to gain a bit of separation. We had Wout van Aert, Mathieu van der Poel, and Julian Alaphilippe. Three strongest riders in the race. It was pretty clear. It wasn't necessarily a timing thing, as it often is at Flanders. It was just a brute strength thing that those guys ended up off the front. As you will have probably seen shortly after that, a moto was hugging the right side of the road and kind of slowing down a bit, and the three riders sort of hopped in its slipstream momentarily. It was kind of in the racing line, which you could put some heat on the moto driver for that particular piece of this. But then Van der Poel and Wout van Aert sort of slid around this motorcycle, and Julian Alaphilippe ran right into the back of it and hurt himself quite badly. Had a pretty nasty crash, broke two metacarpals, had to get surgery this morning on Monday, and was out of the race. And that left two, Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel, who have been rivals since they were, what, 13, 14 years old on the cyclocross? Yeah, basically since birth. Neat little side thing here. Van der Poel was actually wearing the same number as his father when his father won Flanders back in 86. But yeah, so those two, it was just them to the line. They were far and away the strongest in the race. The chasing group never really came close. Oliver Nason tried and a bunch of others tried. Never really got anywhere. The gap sort of hovered around a minute for much of the rest of the race, until the closing kilometers when there was a fair bit of cat and mousing going on. The final sprint, Van der Poel hugged the right side barriers, forced Van Aert to go around to the left, and Van Aert just never fully got around him. I don't think his front wheel ever came level with Van der Poel's. They basically started their sprint at the same time, and it was an absolute drag race all the way to the line. The end gap being a sliver of a wheel, maybe a quarter of a wheel, between Van der Poel and Van Aert, and Van der Poel won his first Tour Flanders.
That finishing sprint was particularly excellent to watch. Van der Poel was just looking over his shoulder the entire time because he was leading in and obviously didn't want Van Aert to get the jump on him. And you could see the peloton coming. I think they finished ultimately 8 seconds back. But you could see them coming, and of course the lens makes it look like it's closer than they are. So there was some sense of, okay, well, we can't just do this forever. One of us has to go. So Van der Poel's just looking back the entire time. And then the explosiveness with which they both jumped up to speed when they decided to go from going, you know, really slow to full on sprint was really awesome. And yeah, it was just a furious drag to the line after that, which Van der Poel won quite narrowly.
I thought Van der Poel's reaction time was either not even split second, but just like either them two are in sync, something else. It was just incredible to see. Either they both knew they were going to go at that exact moment, or Van der Poel's reaction time's just, yeah, unbelievable. But what I did notice about the sprint when they sort of played it again from the top was Wout van Aert. He looked two or three times over to Van der Poel, and you think, is that one half a percent, 1%, what made the difference between the win? Because obviously Van der Poel just had his head straight down, straight for the line, didn't look anywhere apart from straight ahead. And you think, yeah, is that 1% that was that tyre width at the end of the day?
Could have been the rim brakes. Might have been the rim brakes.
No, that'll be it.
No.
I mean, honestly, like Vanderpoel had deeper wheels. I mean, you could probably make a pretty good argument for something like that. That okay, you have you know 6 inches at the end of this sprint, but at the end of the day, we've talked about this numerous times. It really, you know,
came down to the black socks. Came down to the black socks. That was it.
No,
black socks versus white socks.
I gotta say, and I know I'm gonna get a lot of heat for this, but I think that Mathieu van der Poel really pulls off the white bibs. They look great.
Oh, I love them.
Wow, no. I am incorrect. Shocked that Dane is on my side. Holy
he
crap.
Pulls it off.
I was like fully expecting this to be the opposite direction. No, yeah, he looks great. I love the white bibs. No. Keep them. Please wear the white bibs.
Absolutely not.
There's only a few. Van der Poel can pull it off. Cipollini and the other one that I thought could pull it off was Oscar Ferrer when he was world champ at Mapei, but he can't pull it off when he's got bloody blue leg warmers over the top of him at the start. I was just rooting for him to lose once I saw that. I was like, no, that's a fashion faux pas. And I know Brian Holmes so on this one.
Vanderpoel showed up with the leg warmers on, right? Like pulled over his shorts.
He looked like a French like Conti team rider in the middle of winter. It was ridiculous. You only ever see French riders do that.
I mean, he is a Conti team. He's a pro Conti team rider.
Yeah, but not like that. But not a lowly French one.
No, but it's the leg warmers. It's a threat. I wrote a story about this, about Tom Boonen's leg warmers specifically back in my Villeneuve era. You can Google it. It still exists on the internet somewhere. It's a threat because you've got the leg warmers on, and as long as leg warmers on, everyone's like, all right, you know, it's just the guns are holstered, so to speak. The second those leg warmers come off, oh man, better get ready to go because leg warmers just came off. It's a threat. It's mind games.
Keeping your legs warm.
And then if you put them over top like that, they're easier to take off.
No,
my favorite
it doesn't
is still
matter.
Paulini, who used to stick them over his shorts, and then because they don't actually stay up that way, he would then clothespin them. Like safety pin them to his shorts at the top, which seems just silly. Maybe he should just put them underneath his shorts like you're supposed to. But yeah, he won Gent-Wevelgem like that. He won Gent-Wevelgem with pinned up leg warmers.
And his clothing sponsor the whole time is just going like, no, what, like you totally ruined this for us.
What do we think about the Alaphilippe Moto incident? Moving on from leg warmers, even though we could spend all day on that. The Alaphilippe Moto incident. Whose fault is that?
I would love to know. So I didn't see the race live. I did see video clips of this incident, of course, that were just all over the internet. I would love to know what sort of training is required to be a moto driver in a top tier race like that.
The guy's an ex police officer. He's an ex police motorbike rider.
I mean, a lot of them are quite good moto drivers. I mean, anybody who's in the race at the Tour of Flanders has been around the block a couple times. That's pretty safe. It's a safe bet. I think this was it a photo moto or was it a camera moto? Com one. Yeah, I mean, those guys have been around for a very long time. They often have done some bike racing. I mean, like I said, the one rule that I think was kind of broken is you don't take the racing line, and he was kind of in the racing line, which is just the inside of that corner. It's not like they couldn't have gone around him, but that was the shortest way through that corner. But at the same time, you know, he's just sort of slowing down, sitting there, expecting the riders to ride around them, like happens a million times throughout the day. I don't think you could really point at the moto for that. Yes, he was kind of in the wrong place, but also three riders rode right at him, didn't point at it, and then the guy in last hit it. I mean, this is exactly if the three of us go out and are rotating at a pace line out, you know, on some random road in Boulder, and there's a giant pothole in the road, person in the front is supposed to tell you about that. Granted, in a bike race, you don't do a whole lot of like pointing at obstacles, but there's still a fair amount of that still goes on. Like they rode at a motorcycle. What do you expect when you ride at a motorcycle? This is what's going to happen to the person who doesn't see it.
I think the guy had like 20 years experience from what I've seen online. So it's not exactly if he's new to the game. And no, he has said nothing like this has happened to him before. Plus, realistically, if you're going to blame anybody, you're going to have to blame Wout van Aert for taking that line and coming up close to to the motorbike rider.
Yeah, he was trying to get a draft. That's why he was doing it. And he took a risk that then didn't pay off for the guys behind him because Alaphilippe couldn't see around. Let's not forget that Alaphilippe is like 6 inches shorter than Vanderpool, like way smaller than Vanderpool. Couldn't see anything around Vanderpool. And that's the result, is you end up running into a motorcycle. So I think if anybody, yeah, it's Wout van Aert's fault. Moto still, in ideal circumstances, is not in that position at all. But again, this is something that happens over and over and over again. And part of being a professional bike racer is knowing how to avoid the vehicles that are all over the race course, because they are all over every single race course.
Alaphilippe was also messing about with either his zip or the radio, if you notice, just before the crash as well. Plus, yeah, at that point, you're going hell for leather. Your reaction time's going to be a little bit slower as well. So it's a lot of factors going into play. I think anybody who is blaming the motorbike drivers probably not raced a bike before.
Pretty good bet, yeah. Again, it's just sort of unfortunate. I don't know if there's a ton of blame really to go around. I think we'd like to find somebody to blame, but in this case, you know, if anybody, it's you know, don't ride behind the moto. But at the end of the day, it's just kind of an unfortunate racing incident for me. Could have happened, yeah. Could happen much more regularly, honestly. Anything else on Flanders?
One last thing with the crash. There was actually one motorbike in front of that other motorbike. So it's not... Yeah, there was two bikes to avoid rather than just the one. So it's not as if it was just one little motorbike kicking about on its own, not doing what it should have been doing.
Like I said before, you don't want to be in the racing line, but the racing line at a course like Flanders is moving from the left side of the road to the right side of the road every 50 yards or something like that. The entire route is just twisting back and forth, right? And as a result, you can't have the motos switching from left to right to left to right to left to right to stay off the racing line. They pretty much are just tasked with staying very consistent and predictable. And that's exactly what those motos were doing. They were consistent and predictable. And if you run into them while they're being consistent and predictable, as far as I'm concerned, that's on you. Anyway, let's step away from Flanders. Last thing I'll say about that: very, very excited about the rivalry between Van Aert and Vanderpool. It's just going to be so good for the next 10 years. I cannot wait for those two to just be going at it and at it and at it and at it for the next decade.
The thing that really excites me is how closely matched they are, and so many different factors and aspects of their skill sets. Because a lot of times we see great rivalries between riders who are a little bit different. You know, maybe the one rider is a really good time trialist, but the other one's a great climber or a great sprinter. You know, Cancellara and Bonen were kind of different riders, and the things that they did really well were slightly different. But Vanderpool and Van Aert just seem so evenly matched with everything: the engine, the climbing ability, the sprint. And we saw how close the sprint was at this race. And that's kind of exciting, because I think we're just going to get these really close battles for a while.
I feel like someday we're going to find out in the future that, you know, like their official birth dates and, you know, lineages and whatever are not real. Like, we're going to find out like some sort of like superhero story where like they were like twins separated at birth or something like that. Like, you know, one evil twin, one good twin, that sort of thing.
It's going to be a remake of that movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito, but they're both Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes, something like that.
That would be fantastic. All right, let's move on. We got a lot to talk about today. Jumbo-Visma Women. This was announced, and we have a big signing already as well, right?
Well, then they announced the entire team in one go. So yeah, today Jumbo-Visma released a video about how their team is incomplete, but as of next year, it will be complete with a women's team that includes the absolute legend Marianne Vos. Pretty much the entire team is Dutch. They have one German rider, one Belgian rider, one Danish rider, and a British rider. But other than that, it's an entirely Dutch team. And yeah, Marianne Vos, Jip van den Bos from Bols Dolmans is also going over. And the director of the team will be the same director as Park Hotel Valkenburg. So she's bringing over a couple of her riders. But yeah, Ezra Traub is her name, just in case anyone wants to know. But it's going to be a pretty awesome team, it looks like, from the riders that they've compiled. One of the ones I'm really excited about is the British rider Anna Henderson, who used to be a downhill ski racer from Great Britain, which is an interesting thing in and of itself. And she's an amazing descender. She can keep up with Kasia Niewiadoma, so that means something.
Well, do we have any idea where any of the Polycar riders are going to end up? We haven't discussed this too much on the podcast yet, but you've discussed it elsewhere. Wrote a story about it. The team is officially folding. It is done. In fact, they didn't race Flanders. And do we have any idea where any of those riders are going?
Not quite yet. I mean, there's rumblings in the cycling sphere about where some of the riders will go. And it sounds like most of their big riders have offers already or have already signed. But yeah, nothing's been announced just yet. And I'm curious to see if any of them will be added to the Jumbo-Visma roster, because, like, for example, Leah Thomas is one of the top riders at Polycar that could probably make that kind of cut. Also, Michaela Harvey, the young rider on that team, is also really like a promising up and comer who any team would be lucky to have. But no, there's been no announcements yet about any of those riders who haven't already been signed finding teams. One of the riders already announced is going to SD Work, so Bols Dolmans. And then one of them is going to Movistar. But that was announced prior to the team folding, which, yeah, they like announced 2 days before Flanders, we are terminating the team immediately and we're not racing Flanders. So they didn't even like, it wasn't like a we're ending for next year or anything. It was like, we're done.
That's a shame because it's basically the last big race, right?
Yeah, there's two more World Tour races with Dapana on Wednesday and then the Madrid Challenge, which I would be shocked if that happened.
Yeah, we've heard that the Vuelta is not going to finish in Madrid now due to coronavirus. They're going to move the finish, and if that was the case, then the Madrid Challenge would obviously also be moved. That remains, I believe, unconfirmed, but that is the rumor that's floating around at the moment.
Sorry, one last thing about women's teams before we move on. How do you feel about Jumbo getting a team, and now it basically Ineos being the only other super team that hasn't got a women's team? Because you think about it, they're what, 50 million euros a year, that team. Skim 5 million off the top of that, you've got an awesome women's team, and it's hardly going to make much difference to the men's team, is it, 5 million?
I mean, yeah. For a team like Ineos, like for them to save a team like Ekip Polycar, for example, would be nothing to them. But I think it says a lot for teams. Like, I don't think they're the only big team without, like, UAE has been pretty good this year and look like they're going to be a really impressive team going forward. And they also don't have a women's team.
Deconinck Quickstep,
Patrick Lefevre, for sure will never.
Probably not going to start a women's team.
Yeah, like, there's a handful of those teams that don't have women's teams that I think Ineos is different because they financially, it would be no skin off anyone's back to add a women's team to their team. So I do, like, I agree. It is a different situation than like UAE or Deconinck Quickstep. But, you know, my opinion when it comes to women's teams added to men's teams is that if the team in question has no interest in having a women's team, then they shouldn't. Because teams like,
yeah,
like Trek Segafredo, for example, and now Movistar looks like they're really going to put in a lot of effort to have their women's team be a lot stronger. Like, they care about their women's teams and they want them to succeed. And it would seem to me if Ineos and Deconinck Quickstep started a women's team, it would kind of be like,
yeah, you don't want it to be an afterthought or just sort of like, you know, oh, we just have to do this. It should come from a place of genuine, a genuine desire to improve the sport, right? That should be where it comes from. And if it doesn't, then, you know, the sport may be better off without them, to be perfectly honest.
I mean, we would all love for the teams to just voluntarily invest a lot of money into women's teams. But, I mean, you know, we saw what happened with, you know, Title IX in the U.S. as far as, like, U.S. collegiate women's sports. I mean, that was not going to happen unless that was federally mandated. Like, could you imagine what would happen if the UCI said to all the teams, like, okay, from now on, if you are going to have a men's team, you have to have a women's team. Oh, and by the way, the funding has to be this.
Well, there's been rumors about that, too. There's been rumors about the UCI making every World Tour men's team have a women's team as well. And that's just a horrible idea, in my opinion, because you have teams like Canyon SRAM that are very... And Bowles Dolmans, hell, Bowles Dolmans, one of the best teams in the circuit, that don't have a men's team attached and run perfectly well without it.
All right, we must move on. We have many things to cover. The Giro. We can keep this one kind of short. There's like two contenders left at the Giro. Who's left? Who's left, Dane? What's going on?
Yeah, so
who's still healthy?
The weekend was really, pretty decisive because we had a time trial on Saturday and then a really challenging mountain stage to Piancavallo on Sunday. And the Saturday time trial was won by Philip Ogana, surprising no one. But Joao Almeida put in a great ride. And it's starting to make people wonder if he can actually hang on and really win this thing, the race leader. Wilco Kelderman, also a great ride. Not very surprising there. He's a really good time trialist. But Vincenzo Nibali and Jakob Fuglsang, just, you know, not great. Not the performances people expected from either of those riders. Nibali lost almost, well over a minute, almost 2 minutes on Almeida. And... full song, same thing. So not great from either of those riders. And then the next day, same thing. Joao Almeida and Wilco Kelderman, particularly strong in the GC department, while Fuglsang and Nibali just kind of not having it. Theo Gegenhardt won the mountain stage, which was pretty impressive. I think that's his first ever Grand Tour stage win. He's been a rider that we've been talking about for a long time. He's been a prospect for a really long time. Actually, his first World Tour win, actually, period. And with it, he has actually kind of ascended to fourth overall, behind Kelderman and Hindley. So great rides so far from Sunweb. It looks like it's Almeida and Kelderman at this point, both of whom, Almeida has the race lead. Kelderman's only 15 seconds behind, and then Hindley nearly 3 minutes down in third. And Nibali and Fuglsang, who we'd been talking about all the run-up through this race, they're just not really in it anymore. I mean, unless somebody gets into a breakaway, pulls a Thomas de Gent all those years ago. So kind of wild. These are riders that, certainly people knew who they are. They're good riders. Kelderman's been around for a long time. He's been the talent who's been getting top tens for a while, but I think people in the Netherlands will tell you he's been hyped for a very long time. He's been a known commodity as a strong contender for a very long time, and just year after year had not really delivered. And now here he is, in a basically one-person battle.
Yeah, Teo's in fourth, but 1 second behind third. So he's basically, he's certainly podium in his sights. And last week suits him quite well. Big mountains in the last week. We've got a very, very, very hard last week of the Giro coming. He looked great. And we love Teo on this podcast, friend of the podcast. I think I've mentioned this story before, but I interviewed him at California a couple years ago. It was the year that Egan Bernal won. And then he came up at the end of the race and thanked me for interviewing him at the end of the race. It was just the sweetest thing I've ever experienced as a bike racing reporter. It's like, riders don't thank you. They usually tell you to most of the time. He's the exact opposite. Yeah, love Teo. He's a really good guy, and he's looking very, very, very good coming into this last week. I will say, though, that Sunweb was far and away the strongest team in the race. They monstered that stage. I mean, they had three riders left when there was only, I think, six in the entire group. They've now still got two in the top three, and they're looking phenomenal. Kind of a continuation of their kind of dominance of the stages at the Tour de France. Now they sort of turn their attention to the GC. There's something going on at that team right now. They're just riding really, really, really well. They're gelling. Something's happening.
Interesting facet of the Sunweb situation and Kelderman. Kelderman, I think, even though he's not leading the race, he's probably the favorite at the moment. It's close, but I would say I'd probably have Kelderman ahead of Almeida at this point, because he did ride better on that climb on Sunday, and he's got a lot more experience racing the Grand Tours. He's not going to be at Sunweb next year, and this is pretty rare that you see a rider looking like a Grand Tour favorite and, you know, a week away from possibly winning one, heading on to a new team because he's going to Bora Hansgrohe next year after all those years at Sunweb. One of the many riders that Sunweb, you know, has developed and then bid farewell to, along with, yeah, a long list of riders. So Kelderman in his basically what would be expected to be his last Grand Tour with this team, and he's really, you know, turned it on at that last chance.
Big week coming up. Like I said, we'll keep an eye on it. Let you know how it goes down next week. Shoddy, did you have one more thing to add?
Can I just give a big shout out to James Knox, man from my own town back home? He is absolutely killing it. I'm well impressed. Finished, I think, 7th yesterday, something like 14th overall as we record him. Not bad from a bad lad from the Lake District. Used to racing on Greg's Pasties and Kendall Mint Cake. No, it's impressive to see, and it's really encouraging.
Last little bit of racing we've got for you today before we drop into today's Nerd Alert. La Vuelta starts tomorrow. Mañana. Dane, what do we have to look forward to?
As always, a good race. I think the Vuelta is, yeah, I mean, it's been an awesome race for the last, like, decade. I feel like every year we talk about, like, oh, wow, the Vuelta's going to be exciting this year. And I feel like we should probably stop doing that because everybody knows that the Vuelta's going to be great. And this, honestly, the start lists at the Vuelta for the last 10 years, I feel like, I don't know, eight or nine of the 10 have been better than the Giro because riders who go to the Tour have a chance to rest up and then they can go to the Vuelta and we get a lot of the Tour contenders at the Vuelta, including Primoz Roglic and Tom Dumoulin. They'll both be at the Vuelta. I think probably Jumbo-Visma the favorite to win this race with those two powerhouse riders. Thibaut Pinot will be there for those who like to suffer as they root for someone who may or may not make it through the race as a top contender. Ineos with both Chris Froome and Richard Carapaz. Apparently Carapaz is the leader there. Not that surprising given that we still haven't seen Froome be at a top level, whereas Carapaz, he wasn't as great as I think he wanted to be during the Tour, that's for sure, but he, you know, had some great days there at least. So big names from the Tour. Movistar with the multi-rider approach again, Enric Mas and Alejandro Valverde. And Esteban Chavez, we're going to see him, I think, contending for GC or trying to contend for GC, which is exciting. Sepp Kuss will be there for Jumbo-Visma for the American fans. That'll be good. He, of course, won a stage at last year's Vuelta. And I think just another great rider for that team I think Jumbo-Visma has everything that they need to win this race, assuming that they can kind of execute on form. But it should be a good one just because it's the Vuelta. And there are stages, as always, where there are going to be insane climbs. Assuming the race does finish, which that is kind of a conversation for maybe a week from now. We'll see how things are going. I think they are going to have some pretty stringent controls at this race to kind of keep the fans away and hopefully keep this thing a little bit under more control maybe than the Giro and possibly even the Tour. But they'll be going up some pretty iconic climbs. They're going up the Tourmalet. They're going up the Angliru. It's going to be a great run.
Angry Lou?
Assuming they can.
Cool.
Yeah, Angry Lou does feature in this year's race. Stage 12, Angry Lou. and there's a time trial that after the rest day, so it should be, yeah, a great Grand Tour, assuming they can finish all 18 stages of it. Of course, the first 3 days were canceled, unfortunately, so the race just kicks off on a Tuesday. But in the Basque Country, which is always great for bike racing. It's beautiful, first of all, and second of all, the climbing and the fans. Even if there's like one of them every 5 miles coming down on the side of the road, they'll have the passion at least.
Oh, and the food there is so good.
So good.
It's wicked. It's wicked. What the teams will be clamping down on, though, is allowing any rider to have any sort of meat in Irun, because this is, of course, the town where apparently, hang on, Contador had a tainted piece of beef. Many moons ago, that got him booted out of racing for what, a year, 6 months, I can't remember. So yeah, they'll be clamping down on that, but there's plenty of other tapas for them to eat, isn't there?
Is it still a Grand Tour?
It's going to be
just like a pretty good tour.
I think 18
stages, not 21.
I think 18 still grand. I think if you're over 15, I feel like you're still pretty grand.
What's like one step below grand?
Baby grand.
Bonza.
Pretty good.
sponsor tour.
Does anyone else feel like how is there still bike racing? Like how it should, yep. Like it feels it's there's snow on the ground and the Vuelta is starting tomorrow.
Well, there's not snow on the ground outside of Montana. I mean, most places. Yeah.
This is why Pino is going to win, because Pino loves it when it's cold.
Imagine if he does win and the amount of hype that's going to create in France and here on this very podcast, heading into next year's Tour de France. If we see that he can win a Grand, even if he just finishes like second, if he just finishes and does well, there'll be so much hype.
There's going to be an explosion of people with baby goats as pets.
We won't be able to be in the same room as Kaylee for at least a month.
It's true. I'll be so excited.
I honestly think this Vuelta is going to be one for a diesel engine. Valverde, I'm putting my money on him for at least a podium, because you think about it, there's going to be a lot of young guys, a lot of riders who have been going from the start, from January at the Tour Down Under, all the way through, and then not knowing how things are going to pan out, training ridiculously hard for them 3 months of lockdown and then coming into the racing. So there's going to be guys who are just, after the first week, cooked. So I reckon, yeah, it's going to be a diesel engine, somebody who knows how to pace themselves.
I think the weirdness of the season is definitely going to play a role. You know, we know who the big favorites are just based on their names, but there's plenty of riders here, really talented climbers who, you know, maybe if they're in a little bit better form because of the wackiness of the season, it's hard to say. I mean, look at the Giro. Going into the Giro, there were four riders, I think, Geraint Thomas, Simon Yates, Jakob Fuglsang, Vincenzo Nibali, were the clear four favorites. It was like a very strong top tier. None of them, and now it looks like none of them is going to win the race. And I think a part of that is the way this wacky season has worked out. So maybe some of the guys who are kind of maybe a second or third tier in a normal race, something could happen there. Who knows?
Talking about wacky season, Cameron Wirth's down. I forgot about him at Ineos. The gentleman who left the Pro Tour went and did a bunch of triathlons, and then Ineos tempted him back. He's done apparently about 5 races this year, 4 since the calendar version 2.0 kicked off again.
There is a TT in this race, so I wonder if he's going to get up in the morning and swim and then do the TT and then go for a jog after, just because it feels a little more natural.
Right, swimming in the Basque Country ain't too bad. That beach out of Rune is lovely.
It's
hold on, Guillaume Martin's riding. I've just seen the start list. Guillaume Martin is riding. Forget
I've been doing my best
Valverde
to move this podcast on throughout the day, and you guys just keep finding new things.
Nerd alert, nerd alert, nerd alert, nerd alert, nerd alert, nerd alert, nerd alert.
All right, we really must nerd alert. Before we wrap up today, I did say at the beginning of the episode that we were going to be talking about wired versus wireless. We've changed our minds. We're going to be talking about sponsorship and where various bike brands are going. We just want to update you on what is going on this front. Who's got the list? Who's got the list? Someone made a list, right?
I got the list. I got the list.
James got
it
the
is
list.
It is very much a game of musical chairs for official bike sponsors for top teams, top men's teams, I should say. I guess women's teams as well, because they're all in the same equipment. Jumbo Visma is switching from Bianchi to Cervelo for 2021. Sunweb is switching from Cervelo to Scott. And Mitchelton Scott is switching from Scott to Bianchi, who used to sponsor Jumbo Visma, who's now on Cervelo, who used to sponsor. Anyway, yes, musical chairs, very much so.
Musical. The real question is, who's on rim brakes, who's on disc brakes for next year?
Oh, dear God. Abby, you know, I think you were, I don't think this was a part of the recording, but you did some commentary for Flow Bikes, and I think you had said before we started recording that you actually got some comments from people that were requesting to pass along to me that I need to stop talking about disc brakes versus rim brakes. And I just want to state for the record that I only bring this up because our readers and commenters keep bringing it up, because to me, this is
every opportunity. At every opportunity. They've just started dropping it into random like race reports now. They just start arguing about rim brakes and stuff.
It's all Jumbo Visma's fault. It is. Because I guess Ineos as well. But those are the two teams who are still running rim brakes consistently. And then, if those guys win races, then all of a sudden people are like, rim brakes are better.
So will Jumbo Visma keep winning when they're on Cervelo? Yes.
Probably.
No. I mean, they're not going to be on rim breaks anymore. They're going to lose.
Yeah, well.
What I really want to know is, I think it's supposed to come with a name change, but we haven't, I don't think there's been an announced name change for Mitchelton Scott yet. So what if they just go into next year and they're just like, they're Mitchelton Scott still, you know?
That would be very strange if Mitchelton Scott stayed Mitchelton Scott and was riding on Bianchi.
Mitchelton Scott, powered by Bianchi.
That would be weird. I mean, it's just going to be another Jerry Ryan brand,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's kind of what they do over there, is they just move different Jerry Ryan brands around because he just owns the whole thing. So we don't know which Jerry Ryan brand. It could be back to like...
Jayco Caravans.
Is Jayco his Caravans? Yeah. Could be back to Caravans next year.
Oh, man.
I think this is really good
wine right now.
We're going to get a new kit from them, which is very exciting because their kit's been the same for like a decade. That's not true, but
pretty close though.
Well, they're just going to take masking tape and put it over Scott and just write in Bianchi.
I think that's the most, the fact that Jumbo's no longer on Bianchi is a pretty interesting change. I think there's a lot of people out there who do not love the yellow and black with Celeste. So they're going to have a whole, well, unless they decide to ride Celeste bikes. I mean, they could.
Oh, that would be amazing. could you imagine if they painted their Cervelo Celeste? That would
Cervelos.
Be amazing.
Yeah.
I feel like Cervelo might not love that.
Probably not. I don't think
so.
Cervelo's will be
probably
black
not.
And red.
Pretty sure Bianchi owns that color.
Well, I mean, they may have it trademarked or something, but that would be some serious trolling on Cervelo's part.
You could just do like one, you know, one little shade off and no one would ever know.
I would love to know, though, what it looks like at the beginning of the season at the service course when the giant truck shows up with all of the new gear. Like, is it a giant semi-trailer with, like, pallets and pallets and pallets of things? Because, I mean, I've visited a few service courses, and it is ungodly how much stuff is in those buildings.
They come in waves.
It's like, insane.
Yeah, I mean, they do. Yeah, I mean, they would, like, they'd have, like, their first waves of, like, training bikes to get started and, like, you know, all that stuff. But, like, it's still just an ungodly amount of stuff. And wouldn't it be easier if Jumbo Visma is, like, Here, Green Edge, here are all of our Bianchis. And, you know, here's Sunweb. You know, Green Edge just sends over a big old box of Scots. Like, you know, here you go. Like, it's just, like, you know, might as well just put it all in a shipping container and move it over there, right?
Well, and then there's all the old stuff, right? Like, there was recently CCC, which is owned by, yes. You're almost there. Owned by Jim Okowitz. And I forget what his management company is called. But anyway, they've been around the block for a while. They were BMC for a while, and they still had some like warehouse space in California. And they're clearing out all this stuff, and there's like 10-speed Shimano cassettes and like stuff that hasn't been used in years, just getting sold off from these places because they gotta clear it all out too. That's the other thing you gotta remember, that they're bringing all this new stuff in, but then they gotta clear out everything that's not. It's not sponsor correct, right? They sell it. I think they sell most of it. They hawk it all on eBay.
Frames, group sets, wheels, tires, clothing, helmet. I mean, it's everything. It's just this huge, like, just rotating pile of stuff.
Just down the road, Dave, in Chambry, you've got the AG2R Le Mondial service course. And I've been told from somebody who's close to the team, that the warehouse is just full of stuff from previous years. There's Factor bikes in there, still a couple of Focus bikes. I was actually out Saturday with the president of the club that's attached to the team. He was riding Roman Bidar's old Focus bike. And yeah, if you go to the bike, there's a couple of bike shops in the area, and they just have, at the end of the season, all the kit that the teams have never used. All the stuff that aged, and that includes like yellow jersey shorts, pink shorts, polka dot shorts. It's
in
brilliant.
Girona, you see like hundreds of people wearing every single iteration of Garmin, Cannondale, Drapac, EF kit because the service course is there, and every year they like throw open the door and they're like, everything's for sale. And then like all of every single cyclist in Girona who's not a pro and doesn't get their stuff for free, or like, you know, buy it because they want to wear Rafa, they're, well, Not on point. Anyway, they're all wearing all the old, and it's really funny because you'll be riding and you'll see someone from a distance and you'll be like, okay, yeah, it could be Jimmy Whalen, but I see that they're wearing the pink helmet, the EF kit from last year, but they're riding a really crappy Fuji. So...
How much is EF going to make this year when they sell all that Palace kit out the back of the garage then?
That stuff's been gone.
I was going to say, I don't think there's any of that stuff left. There's like, they could probably auction off stickers for $100 at this point.
From the team next
year. That stuff was getting resold on eBay for five times the price. It was like jerseys for literally $500 within 24 hours. Classic. Classic. All right, everybody. It's time to wrap up for today. It's a brief nerd alert. Lots of goodbye gracing. The season is nearing its end. So we will be coming back to like longer nerd alerts and things like that quite soon. But we'll be chatting about the Vuelta next week. Chatting about wired versus wireless drivetrains next week. Talking about who knows what else next week. Thanks for coming along with us. As always, thanks to Industry 9 for sponsoring today's episode. And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.